So I build this product that actually we have paying customers and all these things. For some people, there's this, I don't know if you've heard of the sunken cost fallacy.
Yep.
Right, in relationships and money, you've already spent so much time or money. How can you just leave it and go somewhere new? Right. You'll hear people in relationships, but I've been with them for 5, 10 years. I already have all this time in there. Yeah. But you don't want to have 20 years.
Welcome to the How Leaders Think podcast, the show that transforms you by renewing your mind and giving you new ways to think. I'm your host, Kenny Lang, and with me today is the Dr. Jen Fry. She is a conflict literacy expert. I love that, conflict literacy. I think there's a lot of conflict illiterate people, which
yes,
there's a good reason for you to have a career. A sports geographer. PhD, Michigan State, go green. So we probably just lost a good portion of our listeners. No, it's just
good. Get out of here.
There you go. Spray yeah, them. We don't need them moving ahead.
We don't
ahead.
Need them.
Yeah.
The myth that take riffraff.
Michigan, yeah, Michigan University. Get out of here. She is a tech founder, a TEDx Duke speaker, and veteran international presenter. She leads Jen Fry Talks, a conflict literacy firm that sits at the intersection of conflict and culture and turns conflict into a leadership advantage. Amen.
Mm-hmm.
By building cultures of clarity, accountability, and trust. A former NCAA volleyball coach with 15 years in the Pac-12, Big Ten, and MEAC, Jen has delivered 200 plus talks and training. That's a lot, y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Her work equips leaders and teams to engage, speak, and repair, ooh, love that, with precision so they leverage tension instead of being leveled by it. Man, just rewind, clip that. She's the author of I Said No, How to Have a Backbone and Boundaries Without Being a Jerk. Welcome to the show, Jen.
I felt like you need to have those sounds. Yeah. Hello. Yeah. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, like a morning radio show.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a have some weird like noises from animals, stuff like that. I'm sure my editor could fix.
I feel like work that in. Yes, they need to. Yeah.
We've had some weird stuff happen, some inserts. So this may be one of them. So I like that. It's already very enthusiastic. Jen, I'm excited to have this conversation. Tell me what is on your mind.
What's on my mind? Ooh, there's so much stuff. We don't have that much time. I would say in terms of leaders that conflict, how you as a leader is managing conflict is probably detrimental to your company.
I agree. Let's dive into that. Well, let's start from the place of like, what is the prevailing wisdom that allows that to happen? Because whenever I notice somebody is like specialized, got an education, speaks, you know, repeatedly, writes books about a topic, it means that this isn't something everybody's just doing naturally.
Yeah.
Right. So what's the thinking and the wisdom that allows leaders to handle conflict so poorly that it's not just like, I could be better, but it's actually detrimental to their organization and their leadership.
What makes it so detrimental is that leaders don't have an emphasis on it and how it can completely destroy their company. And when I say destroy their company, I don't mean the big blow-ups, because that's what people usually think of is with conflict, right? Is someone screaming, yelling, storming out, you know, that type of stuff. That's not at all what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about in terms of detrimental is the small insidious things that happen consistently throughout the day, weeks, months, that cause your talent to stop being talent. That they're just like, I'm not even going to say anything. I'm just going to do what I say. It's when you have a big project and there's some glaring, obvious thing that needs to be fixed, but you've created a culture where either no one says anything or they're afraid that people are going to react so aggressively that they see the glaring thing that can completely derail a project and they don't say anything. And then the project's derailed. It costs a lot of money, reputation, and people just aren't willing to say something. And so that's what I mean by this insidiousness. It's when you bring in top talent, you finally recruited this person that is amazing in XYZ. But for them to do XYZ at your company, it means it's going to make people uncomfortable. It means that they're going to have to do things that they didn't do. It means that they're going to have to stay in their lane. It means that more is expected of them. And they don't want to do that. And instead of you as a leader saying, okay, I know when we bring Jen in, it's going to rock these people's boats. It's going to do this. It's going to do, these people are going to grapple. Instead of understanding this, you put Jen in there and all these things start occurring. And then Jen can't do the things that Jen was brought in to do. And then Jen just ends up leaving because now all these people, everyone loves talent until the talent starts to shake things up. Then they don't want the talent anymore.
Yeah, they love the results that you can bring until they are confronted with the way that you achieve your results, right?
Yes, yes, 100%.
That's like, I encounter that so often is people are, oh, yeah, I really, really want that. Like, even interpersonally, they like, oh, I would love to, you know, stand on a stage, you know, and give 200 talks. It's like, okay, are you willing to do X, Y, and Z? No, I just want people to book me and to do that. It's like, okay, well, then you're not going to get that result. It's like people with me and my wife, they're like, oh my gosh, your kids are so well behaved, or they really are helpful and service oriented. And then we start talking about their kids like, oh, well, you might want to try doing this, this, and this with them. They're like, oh, I couldn't do that, so harsh, that's this. I was like, how do you think my kids ended up like this? Not that they're perfect. They are far from it. But it's so funny to me is that people will brag on something, but then when you tell them how to get there, they're totally against it. So what I hear what you're saying about, like, there's this almost like inherited culture that talent might step into that sort of boundaries them from being their best and doing what they do well. But what role does the leader play in creating a situation where we see the glaringly obvious fix, but nobody wants to say anything? I can't imagine leaders are out there like, oh my gosh, I just wish people would stop pointing out things we could do better.
Yes, or they do. Yes.
What is the belief behind that then?
So a few things, like, I hate that I'm like, yes, absolutely, they'll do that. So a few things behind it is that, for instance, let's take it like this. We're going to kind of go, this is going to be a really weird analogy, but I need people to stick with me. Okay. So for instance, we have to think of a better way for this drink, right? Because once we open it, you have to drink it immediately or it goes flat. And so we're sitting here and we spent millions of dollars building this, but now we know we have to pivot to build something else. And so people right now, already the leader's like, we've already spent all this money, what are we gonna do? Knowing that people are like, I have some ideas, and maybe I have this idea, but I know you're so locked in with this idea, and you might want to only change something on this idea. You don't want to make the drastic move to this idea. And so because you are so locked in with this, if I try and say, hey, Kenny, have you maybe thought about the, and I bring up just a small thing. Absolutely not, Jen. That's not a part of our product. Our product is metal and blah, 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 blah. And so I'm trying to bring up ideas to help innovate. And you are so stuck on this thing that you can't move away from it. And when I try and push on it in a meeting, you come at me, Jen, you know, you'll come at me or you'll negate it. Jen, no, it's not worth it. We don't. And I'm like, hey, I got proof that this is cheaper, blah, 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 blah. And you don't want to listen to me because you are so lost into your idea. And that's one of the problems is that when we talk about conflict is when you have to be willing to put this idea out and just let it ride. And then chip away, almost like a rough diamond, and chip away at it from every end to then make it a real diamond. But so many people are so tight with their idea that they take it personal when you're like, well, actually, we can't close this. Once it's open, it's open. And they're so tied into their idea that they can't think of anything else. And now it's a personal disagreement against you. And then the way it will happen is that then I'll go to my coworker and be like, can you believe that Kenny tried to do blah, blah, blah? And Kenny, and now I'm my coworker instead of being thinking, my coworker knows that we need to change this. But now me as the boss, I'm telling my coworker how they think that this person could do that. I don't understand. And even though my coworker might agree with that other person, they got to agree with me because I'm the boss. And that's how we start to see that you said it's not this way of a boss being like, I don't want innovation. But what they are is they're tied to stuff so much that they stop innovation from occurring because they silence all the other voices that might push back and change stuff.
Gotcha. The current system works for them. Maybe they were a part of it and they're over-identifying with the current solution, right? That's what you're saying. It's like, now you're not attacking the idea or saying we should change the idea. They're taking it personally and saying like, well, this idea is me.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they're over-identified with it. And then the sort of like death by a thousand cuts affects you instead of the big blow up that is highly visible. It's almost like a slow growing cancer that just like festers. And I love the word that you used, insidious, that sort of navigates its way through the company and then it can't operate because people can't be open. They can't be honest. They can't innovate. Instead, everybody just wants to iterate because that feels safer.
Well, so I own a tech company. And one of the things I do is I pivot really fast. I pivot fast that in ways that is uncomfortable for people. So an example is I had an app for about 3 years and I spent a lot of money on it, a lot. Mm-hmm. And in November, there were some big mistakes by the app team. And I just said, let me see if I can do this myself. There's a lot of different solutions, vibe coding, all these things. So I was like, let me see if I can just build it. So I build this product that actually we have paying customers and all these things. And for some people, there's this, I don't know if you've heard of the sunken cost fallacy.
Yep.
In relationships and money, you've already spent so much time or money. How can you just leave it and go somewhere new? Right? You'll hear people in relationships, but I've been with them for 5-10 years. I already have all this time in there. Yeah, but you don't want to have 20 years. And so for me, I literally shifted. I closed down the app and built this whole thing on a platform. And for some people, that's really, really uncomfortable because of the speed of the pivot. And if I had different people around me, they would have been like, whoa, no, maybe you can take some of that code. Maybe you can do this. Maybe you can do that. And they would have tried to stop this speed. Whereas the people around me were like, okay, let's do it. And you have to have a different mindset to not be so stuck on this thing that maybe made you money and you spent hours and days and on, but to be able to say, I need to be able to shift fast and move forward at a speed that can be uncomfortable to people. And if your company is not used to iterating and thinking and growing and trying stuff out, it's super easy to just stop the people who want to do that because it's uncomfortable because it then has you have to sometimes have to reshape and rethink your job.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the sunk cost fallacy. That was something I was thinking about as you were talking is the I'm going to go ahead and throw good money after bad or good or time, you know, talent, whatever it may be, just because I've already spent this amount. It's like, well, that almost makes it dumber. There's a saying, and I'm probably going to butcher it, but it's from a leadership speaker and writer, Andy Stanley. I heard him on a podcast once say, you've got to, it's like, marry the principles, but date the model.
Yes.
And so like the model for in your example was, you know, team versus vibe coding on Lovable or something like that, right? But the principle was that the concept of the app was good. That was solid. It could help people that, you know, you've tested all those things, but you pivoted the method, the expression, the model by which you were bringing it to market. And I think that that's people get overly invested in the way something's done, not the goal or the mission that you're out to accomplish. I think some of that may be a little easier to see in, say, the world of sports that you occupied and you were coaching college athletes. Is there something from that that has helped you see this more clearly in that, like, well, you have a goal, win the championship, right? Like, that might be clear, but in your example of, like, you know, Coke Zero in a can versus in some sort of, you know, like, plastic bottle with a screw top lid, that can start to feel murky. So is there something that's helped you bridge that gap from the world of sports into the world of business and leadership? And how do we make those pivots and not give into the sunk cost fallacy?
So I think those are two good questions. I think the first thing is people don't realize the speed at which sport moves at. Sport moves at such a fast speed in a few different ways. Think about it. If you're at a game and you're coaching, mm-hmm. and we'll just say basketball because it's basketball season right now. And it's a timeout. It's 72-72. You have, I don't know, 10 seconds left on the clock. The coach will literally draw up a new play that no one's ever practiced and say, not only do you have to implement this play, your part, you have to do it or else you will lose this game. And you have to be able to do all this new stuff in like 10 mm-hmm. seconds. You have to learn, retain, and do. That is not a normal speed for any other job. I mean, yeah, right. Like health stuff, like, you know, like emergency stuff, but a normal job, people aren't moving that at that speed. You have to move at a very fast speed. And people don't think about that. When you're a coach, you have to be able to see what's going on in the court and have a whole strategy and then be willing to scrap it because you got a new piece of information and be able to explain it in a way that your team can implement. I mean, there are mm-hmm. times where you spent days scouting a team for this one player in this one position, and then you start playing and you realize you got to like just rip it up because that player is playing in a new position in a new way that you all haven't even practiced. And so you have to do so much of that all the time. And that your question's great because it didn't make me think about how many transferable skills that I have with that.
Yeah.
There's so much that's transferring that I didn't even think about. And so as a coach, you are doing so much stuff all the time that you move at a quick speed that when you get a real job, you're like, what do I do now? I've done all my stuff in an hour. Like, that's why I used to work. Yeah. Like, when I moved from coaching to a program coordinator, I would have all my stuff done and planned out because when you coach, you have to have your whole season planned out way ahead of time. You can't just mm-hmm. get all willy-nilly with stuff. So I would have everything planned out, early meals, all this stuff, where in normal program coordinator, they would do it like week by week. My stuff would already be all planned out. And so I think that's what helped me. In regards to the sunken cost, you have to trust that what you're going to get when you move away from it is going to be far greater than what you're going to lose.
So it's not that there's a you're not going to lose situation, but it's that it's going to be a net.
You're going to win more.
Yeah. You might still lose, but you're going to win more, or what you invest in. Like, I might lose some money in this transition, but I'm going to make more in the future because we pivoted the product or something like that.
And what you're losing. So for instance, I'll use this example. The company I just left was my second app developer. And my first one, whenever people talk about shifting app developers, they make it seem like you are crossing the Sahara on your toenails, right? Like, they're like, it's the hardest thing. Oh my, like, they make it seem like it is so hard. And a lot of this, it's just a little bit more time consuming. But I knew if I didn't change app developers, it would have killed my company. So yeah, it's hard, but what hard would I rather have had? And there were some good things out of that first app developer. And so I had to make the shift. And some people could be like, oh my God, you lost so much money. I looked at it as I got out cheap because it would have cost me more. So even though I spent what anyone would think of as a lot of money, I felt like it was cheap because I could have lost more money. Same thing with this. Gotcha. I spent over six figures with this current app company. And some people would be like, but couldn't you keep the code? Couldn't you keep this and that? No, I couldn't, because of where we had to go. If I were to try and spend the time to figure out what pieces of code and like, if I'm taking all of that time to figure out what is salvageable, mm-hmm. I'm going to miss out on the time I can have building and reiterating. Yeah,
it's almost like debt that you're just dragging behind you, as opposed to just let's make the clean break and move ahead.
Yeah.
So one of the things I'm hearing is you've got to make peace with the reality that risk loss is inevitable.
Yes.
You can't mitigate 100% against, well, we can't lose any money. Okay, well, then you can't have any innovation.
No.
We can't make any mistakes. Okay, well, then you're not going to do anything great, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of things in sports, which I, you know, we talked about that, you know, before, is just a shared love of sports, is a lot of the stuff that we would see at these great sports moments that we reflect on, and they make 30 for 30 films about, people were trying stuff. They were, they were making a big risk. Like, again, I love basketball and I'm a huge like Michael Jordan and 90s basketball fan. But you think about the number of game winning shots he hit, there's a big risk. What if he missed? And there's actually stats that he missed more potential game winning shots than he made. But because he kept doing it, he made way more than anybody ever did and won more games in more spectacular ways because he kept trying. And there's other examples of that in sports. I want to tie this back into.
Well, can I hit on some of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think a few things that my financial advisor, and I appreciate him, he was like, you got to spend money to make money. Like, you have to. If people think you're going to make money without spending money, you have you've got screws rolling around in there. Like, you have to spend money. You have to spend sometimes quite a bit of money to make money. Mm-hmm. Like, you just have to. You can't sit here and think that you're going to spend zero money and be making thousands and hundreds. It's impossible. And so you have to be willing to spend money. And I think the next thing is that if you own tech, because tech now moves at such a fast speed. Mm-hmm. And you have to be willing to move fast and make mistakes. You have to. And mm-hmm. so the thing I would suggest for you to have is have a mistake spectrum. What is a zero mistake, a one mistake that you're like, if someone on your staff makes it, you're like, girl, I don't even care. What's a 10 where you're like, you're probably going to lose your job? Right. What is the mistake? Like, you have to have the spectrum, because you can't treat every mistake as a 10 and expect you're going to innovate fast. And that's what I think a lot of CEOs mm-hmm. don't think about. They take mistakes and everything is a blow up. Well, then you can't innovate. So I had to release, like, if someone made a mistake or I did, okay, like, that's fine. And one of the big mistakes that actually got me to leave my app team is they made a mistake in the logic for the text messages, which sent 4,967 text messages in like 5 hours to like 400 people. So you imagine hundreds of text messages. That's a massive mistake. And I feel like they did not apologize. They did not refund money. They were just like, oh, we fixed it. And I was like, you just sent 5,000 text messages to my customers. And I'm the one over here. Luckily, I knew them. And so I wasn't being shot to death. But any other company, if you don't have a close relationship, baby, they will skin you alive for that. And I know if I was getting hundreds of verification text messages that I couldn't stop, I'm going to be mad. And they didn't handle it well. They didn't apologize. Like, I did, I would have been mortified. I'm going to give you a month free. Like, I would be so embarrassed and worried about your company. And they weren't. And I was like, I can't work with that type of mistake and that lack of acknowledgement and accountability. And so I say that of, you have to know if you're going to innovate fast, you have to know mistakes are going to happen. Mm-hmm. What are acceptable mistakes where you're like, these cannot happen. And you have to be able to ride that wave, knowing that speed and mistakes are going to be the same thing.
So let's bridge between the mistakes and the conflict piece. Is them the way in which this app company handled, or rather mishandled, the situation, is that an example of handling conflict poorly to the detriment of your own organization and future.
Yes. Yes.
So mistakes, I think, do surface conflict, right? Nobody likes mistakes. So let's be honest about that. No one, and you're not saying, hey, I really love it when people screw up. Nobody's saying that, but I love the idea of a
spectrum. I kind of do.
Sometimes it can be fun.
Not fun, but trying stuff. If you're making mistakes, like we're trying to push the envelope and try stuff.
Sure, but you would have rathered it be successful. You know, all things considered, you probably would like, hey, you tried something, let's go. Or I'm a fan of the term or saying you win or you learn. Mm-hmm. Right? Like mistakes are a chance to learn. I've even in times when I'm dealing with somebody, sometimes like, oh, I made a mistake. I did this. Like, you know what? That actually gives us a chance to repair. Like you had mentioned in your bio, the whole rupture repair dynamic is you can't repair something that doesn't rupture, but oftentimes that gives you the opportunity to make something stronger than it would have. It's an opportunity to build trust and knowing how will you handle things when they don't go perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that reveals character.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot of your work in building trust and accountability, you almost can't do that if everything's going smoothly, right?
No, there's a great quote I love, and it says that conflict shows us the depth of our relationships. And
wow.
The reason why I said, like, I kind of like mistakes because we'll use the sport analogy. You never learn by winning. No team who has been consistently winning will learn. You never will. And it's shitty. You learn by the mistakes. You learn by losing. That's when and I hate it. I have lost pitch competitions. And when they say the reason why, I'll be like, okay, you're right. But I wouldn't have never known that. Or I think about the iterations with my company. I would never have known that had I not done the iterations, had I not figured things out. And that's why I say, like, mistakes, I understand that my reaction to mistakes can either keep pushing the innovation forward or completely stop it. And so I've had to really train how I interact after a mistake so that they don't feel like they're scared of my reaction or they're scared of keeping to try something out.
Is that the crux of handling the conflict mistakes generate and how they're handled?
Yes.
Is that the central pivot point that you want leaders to understand and be aware of and to improve upon? Because I'm a fan of saying, like, you're never playing for this conversation. You're playing for the next one.
Yeah.
So, like, if I shut you down now, we're not going to have the next conversation, more than likely. Right? Like, I want to make it so that the next time, even if I'm super pissed off or something like that, the next time, though, something does come up and we could solve it, and maybe it is a bigger deal, that you do feel like you can't bring it up. I may be misquoting this, and somebody's probably going to like leave a comment or email me, and then I'll ignore it. I'm just kidding. But I think about, I think, was it the Challenger shuttle? Like, people knew that the seals around different things like weren't working, but they didn't feel like they could speak up and say, hey, like, I know you really want to get, you know, launch this. There's political pressure. There's all these things that we got to get going. But this is literally unsafe. And sure enough, people lost their lives. And people watched the shuttle explode on television because they didn't say that, like you were talking about at the beginning, there's a glaring mistake in something that we could fix. But I have to imagine the way in which mistakes or surfacing that in the past amongst that team or in that division were handled contributed to a lack of, it's not worth me speaking up and getting fired over this.
Well, that, and potentially they maybe have, they tried to speak up about it, but they're like, shh, it'll be fine. We have to get this off. And that type of thing, where instead it was like, okay, this is more important. And even though, because people in power, I've noticed, hate, how do I say this? People in power, like, hate having to deal with outside conflict. So what they'll do is they'll rather shut the inside conflict than to deal with the political pressure of saying, like, we even though we have this whole thing and this whole spectacle, we have to stop it because it's unsafe. They don't want to deal with hearing the people, oh no, let's do it, all that pushback. So instead of dealing with the pushback, they're just going to silence people. And I see that quite a bit, that people do not want to deal with pushback. Like I'm on the Baltimore Mediation Center board. I'm also a mediator. And one of the things that they talk about is going towards the smoke. You're mediating, someone says something explosive. Most people would be like, oh, I'm not going to touch that. We're taught to go towards the smoke. And so I say that of, I'm okay going towards the smoke. Other people are not. So in that case, the smoke that they were worried about was the news, politicians, money, their boss, all these things that they are worried about. And instead of saying, I understand people are going to be pissed and I'm going to have to deal with it. And people are going to be coming for me and I'm going to have to deal with it. It is what it is. But the safety of these people is more important. Instead of that mindset, it's like, oh my gosh, politicians are going to be mad. My boss is going to be mad. And instead of me acknowledging that these people are going to be mad and I'm going to have to deal with it and take it, instead of that, they will just shush people and then the outcome will be the outcome and hope nothing happens, right? And do that hope. Well, I hope it goes well. And that's one thing I would say for leaders is that you got to be okay with the smoke. You have to be okay with people saying stuff. And so many people are not used to conflict or dealing with that. So because they're not used to the smoke, they won't give the hard conversation. They won't give the real feedback. They'll hold stuff in. They won't allow the people to innovate and talk because they're not used to the smoke. But, okay, smoke is normal if you're a leader. You've got to be ready for the smoke. And if you're not prepared for it, you are a detriment to your team. I will die on that hill. You are a detriment because someone at the top got to be able to handle the smoke so that other people can do their job. And it might be that then after that, Kenny, we got to have a conversation about a mistake or something, but I got to be willing to handle the smoke. And like your example of the challenger, they were worried about probably other people and the reaction. So instead of just listening to this thing that could kill people, they're like, oh, it can't be that bad. It was that bad.
Right. They valued their own comfort in the moment over other people's lives.
Yeah.
So if a leader's, I am 100% with you. I think conflict is just a part of the game of business and leadership and everything else. As a matter of fact, confrontation has been a core value of mine over the last probably like 11, 12 years. Which freaks people out. I'm like, no, it's like stuff's going to happen, but we got to address it. It doesn't mean we get to be a jerk about it, you know, to the subtitle of your book. Like you can speak up without like pointing a finger and punching someone in the face. Like those are some extremes. But let's say a leader's listening to this and they're like, either they are the top person or their aspirations are to be that top person. And they're listening to you going, okay, the smoke's coming, the conflict's coming, the mistakes are going to happen. I can't avoid that. I want to make sure that I'm someone who can handle it, who navigates this well, who turns that, I'm looking here, the turn the conflict into a leadership advantage, as you say. What's a baby step that leader can take in the next 24 hours, spending little to no money, to start to cultivate that mentality or those skills in themselves?
If I was a leader, I would ask my executive assistant, how do I handle conflict? And right there will tell you, do they pause? Are they like, what do you mean? And their reaction to that question will automatically tell you what the situation is. Are they like, oh, you want to know, Kenny? And then they give it all to you because they're not afraid. They're not afraid of repercussions. They're not afraid of your attitude. They'll just give it. But if they're like, can you explain, Kenny? What do you mean? What context? And they like ask all these questions and give themselves time. You already know what the situation is. Like you can tell they don't even have to truly answer without you knowing what the deal is.
Right. Their lack of answer is the answer.
Yeah. Their questions and trying to give context so that they can have this really small like example. Maybe that tells now, when, where, with who, why. All of those things are just giving them time.
Like, man, on Tuesdays at 10:07, when you've had bacon and orange juice, like, you were just on and you're such a joy to be around.
Yeah.
Like, what about all the other times?
Huh? What? I don't know what to do.
Sorry, I'm going through a tunnel. You're sitting in front of me.
Damn it.
Never mind.
Damn it.
Like, Mom, is that you? I'm coming. I love that. There's a question I was reminded of this week at my C12 peer group. We were actually talking about giving and receiving feedback and humility and things like that. And it was a question from the book, I think it's called Leveling Up by Ryan Leake. And it says, what's it like to be on the other side of me?
I love that.
I didn't even know it came from him, but somebody taught me that question, or I learned it at a conference. And I asked that to some close friends and one who is a bit of a mentor to me. The answers were painful. Not that they're like, you suck, but you know, they said, here's some good things. He goes, but I think what you're asking is like, what's the downside? Like, what's the thing I don't know? And I sit there and I took it. And that was one of the things that we were talking about this week in my group is if you ask those kind of questions, whether it's how do I handle conflict? What's it like to be on the other side of me? Or one of my personal favorites, what do you know about me that I don't, but I should?
I like that. I'll write that down too.
That one's a terrifying question. I try not to ask it, you know, maybe like once a year, every 3 years, something. I don't know, with a lunar cycle, but is to listen. You don't defend, you don't explain, you merely say thank you, and that's it. Or I needed to hear that. If you have a clarifying question, sure, but otherwise, you're gonna make it worse. If you ask that kind of question and you genuinely want to know, then you have to go into those situations, I think, prepared to give a response. I don't know if you found some other tools when inviting that question on how you coach people to respond, or, you know, is there a thank you? Is there something that helps really seal that moment and make it valuable so that you're building towards something?
One of the things I just say is thank you for your feedback. That is literally what I say. And then after that, maybe on the hour a day, I'll send them like a message, a text, an email. Hey, thank you very much for being honest with me. I really appreciate it. And that's it.
Gotcha. Just a reinforcement.
Yeah. Like, you don't have to go into some soliloquy and, you know, be up on the book. Thank you guys for the, like, you don't have to do that. Just like, thank you for that feedback. I really appreciate it. Because more than likely, especially if it's someone that is like a subordinate, you pay for, you know, their check, they're leaving that worried about their job. They're worried. And so just to say, hey, thank you, I appreciate that, and leave it, it is what it is. But to not go into any more, I'll see sometimes where people will try and, like, I'm a person that I joke about everything. I'd post on my Facebook, like, good, bad, or ugly, you tell me something, I'm going to probably respond with a meme. Like, I just am. It might not be appropriate for the meeting. I'm just am. But I think sometimes I will see, like, I'll give an example. When I do my workshops on conflict, and I will, like, give examples and stuff, and then I'll see people afterwards who will be like, I don't want to be too aggressive, and like make jokes like that. I'm always like, what are we doing? Like, that's not funny. That you have to kind of understand what you're doing, especially if you're a person that people have a problem with, right? Like, sometimes you don't have to joke about it. And so I want to really push on that you accept the feedback, but also pay attention to how you joke about it if someone brought it up as a real problem, because then you're might make too much of a light of it. And they, if I know he didn't go off on me, but he joked about it every single time. If I maybe an example would be if I said, you're too short in your emails, something like that. And then afterwards in your email, be like, I don't want to be too short. I want to make like stuff like that. It's like, you don't have to do that. They don't want to share.
Right. Which I think that's the other ditch to fall into in terms of receiving feedback poorly, and which I've seen a lot. Some of that does depend on the relationship. if you have mm-hmm. a closeness, and you typically do joke around about mm-hmm. those sorts of things. It's like, we know each other's faults and we're going to joke about it is one thing. But especially if it is in a situation where there's a difference of power dynamics. Yep. Now, Jen, if people want to know more about you, your work, how you're helping people, or go find your book or your talks, where do you send them? Where can they connect?
Yep. Jen Frey Talks on literally everything. If you type in Jen Frey Talks on any platform, you're going to come to me. Anything. So that's the way. If you want, for my book, jenfreytalks.com, you could buy the book directly from me, which is better. You get stickers and a bookmark and my Herbie Hancock.
I love it.
Right? You could go on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, buy through me. But anything else, I'm on LinkedIn, anywhere. Follow me. I have a podcast called Five with Fry, where it's 5 minutes of me talking. So yeah, I'm kind of all over the place.
Gotcha. I love that. We'll link all of that in the show notes. And so you gave us a rich litany of links. So thank you mm-hmm. for that. And you didn't add all of the like UTM parameters that some people copy and paste into this of like, we don't need that attribution. We just need to stop at the username. But thank you so much. This was a lot of fun, a lot of energy and some of my favorite conversations happen like this. I'm sure we will have more topics in the future. But ladies and gentlemen, you just got like a masterclass in conflict and understanding it. And it may have been tough to swallow. It may have been hard to hear. I know a lot of what Jen is doing is really just holding up a big mirror. And we don't always like what we see. We're all trying to grow. And the mistakes we make, as she taught us, are not often fatal. They're not tens. They're down in the 1, 2, 3s. I almost went 1, 2, 3 into the 4, but then that would have like taken us into a Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre at the door. Look, I had a different life. Don't let this fool you.
And the pink jacket. Don't let the pink jacket behind him fool y'all either.
Yeah. Oh, that's a, what is this? A Moana blanket? Yeah. So that's my wife's gaming chair is over beside me. But if you got something out of this, like, rate, review, leave a comment, interact with this, because when you do that, the algorithm picks up on it, and it is a free and easy way to get this sort of content in front of other people like yourself who need it. They're on the same journey. They're just trying to take their next step. And this is an easy way for you to pay it forward and make it a positive impact on the world by just listening and hitting that like or subscribe, smash that like and subscribe button, as I think the kids say, or maybe they don't anymore. I don't know. I'm getting older. But until next time, change the way you think, you'll change the way you lead.
Yes. See ya.